Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the music cognition class for the 16th of March. Today, I believe, is the 17th day of the semester. Today, I want to talk about prediction or in music. Actually, it's going to be more like expectation. And I'll say at the beginning that I'm presenting a theory that I'm still trying to work my way through, so I don't know how much material I have yet for class. But at least we will be able to see the broad outlines of the theory. But let's go ahead and jump to, we still need to spend the provost money on something. So be thinking. Goals for, well, that's the worst case. I mean, the worst case scenario is we'll have dinner somewhere, but you know, doing something more interesting. I'm afraid it doesn't work that way. No, that's like the stimulus package. Has anyone ever tried to calculate how much money an American each American would get if you divided up $700 million among the United States population? Well, pick a number, you know. Whichever stimulus package you want, divide it up among the country's population. Oh, well. Let's talk about music. Yeah, it's a lot of money. I figured my wife and I could each go buy a house. Okay. Oh, I've got a question. Yes. What do you think arouses, so it's not a rhetorical question, discuss this with a partner. What do you think arouses an emotional response in general and in music in particular? So talk about that for a second. What do you think?
Yeah, but
Okay. In general, what arouses an emotion? Yes? Any stimulus connected to a memory. Okay. People agree with that?
Right, but that's my point. That there would be a stimulus that reminded me of that memory.
That if you had, like, no. Mm-hmm. Your emotional
this is way more complicated than what we're going to say today. There's this whole argument about what emotions are for, which I don't really want to get into. Memories, did anyone say anything different? Yes?
Well, we were saying that it could be directly tied to a memory or recall something in you, but even that there's ways for things to influence emotional response that's completely divorced of any of your previous experiences. Like, the first time that I saw an image of the Holocaust that isn't tied to a previous memory I had, but can still invoke an emotional response. There are things that oftentimes remind you of something else and then tie in the emotions, but it doesn't have to remind you of something.
Okay. So, an image of the Holocaust arouses an emotion in you. What's in the image?
Death? What does death look like?
Well, but the image I'm thinking of is extremely specific. I mean, there's several variations on it. What's in the image? People are in the image. Okay. What state are the people in? Okay. I'm thinking of some of the images of emaciated bodies stacked up like cordwood. That's what I'm thinking. When I see those images, it freaks me out in the wind. Okay, so you're saying that arouses an emotion directly through some causal mechanism that's direct. Yeah, okay.
Of other humans. That is, like, to you knowing that is
okay.
I mean, if you look at that picture,
you don't really...
Perhaps. Yeah, well, there's... Okay, that actually takes us to... That's what characterizes people who are 2 years old? Okay, yeah. Lack of knowledge. Yes?
Okay.
Here's my image of emaciated people stacked up like cordwood, stiff, could be dead. I mean, you kind of hope they're dead. Compare that to an image of what normally people look like. What's your image of what people normally look like? Y'all, for example. Plum cheeks. Yeah? Not emaciated. Everyone looks healthy and well-fed here. No one's stiff as a board. Okay. So that should be a hint right there. Sort of what we're going to say today disagrees with you in the sense that there are emotions without memory in some sense.
Okay,
the idea is that, okay, what I'm getting at is I'll give you a theory for what was just said, was that your expectation of how people should look is violated by that image. Okay? And it's violated massively on many different ways. The fact that people should look well-fed, the fact that you don't actually... If people die, you try to treat their bodies with respect, you don't stack them like cordwood, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there could be several kinds of violations of our expectations of what people look like, right? So that's an interpretation that's going to be parallel or analogous to what we're going to say, what this model I'm going to explain today says about music. Motion music. Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, like, in the brain, uh-huh. I think of examples where you could have an emotional response without memory.
Yes.
And so I guess, like, wet bears or Aphex Twin, like, very chaotic...
Venetian...
snares. It's like intelligent dance music. It's like very, very...
Intelligent...
dance music.
Okay.
Like,
you're going to have to speak a little slower.
Sorry. It doesn't really matter what it is. So the point is that it's, like... Like inherent, or like it seems to be inherently unpleasant. And now, obviously, you can make the response that like it's just not what you would expect. And now, on that level, that's possible. And the problem is that there's no way to verify that unless you.
Yeah.
Going to be hard.
Yeah. Then you probably couldn't communicate with them. So.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So like.
But there. Okay. Today we will. Yeah. Hold that thought and see how it matches up to the model that I'll sketch today. This model does actually suggest that there could be emotional reactions without memory if you have certain built-in expectations. And in fact, this is a model of built-in expectations.
Okay,
yeah. But that they still have to come from somewhere, so that part is still unknown. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Just like differences.
Sure. Yeah, and that's those kinds of things we are probably just outside the purview of music theory, maybe. I mean, I'm going to sketch a cognitive model. Again, the neurological underpinnings are just not quite clear yet. So, sure. I mean, I concede that that certainly neurotransmitter manipulations will make you feel emotions. Sure. Okay, that might be a separate issue, yeah.
Well, no, not necessarily. The relevance could be in that certain music without being actually music per se can measure at a more basic level, like by a certain way without actually being, wouldn't be tied into like an emotion.
Sure. And again, a lot of the ultimate neurophysiological mechanisms for this aren't really known, so there's going to be a gap between a cognitive model and the neurological model. And again, we don't know what the exact connection is, and of course we don't know the evolutionary significance of music, which might explain a whole lot of this stuff too. So it's fun speculating what it might be. You wanted to say something?
I was going to say, I think evidence is not a memory for...
Sure. Now again, that may have something to do with memory, but you know, I don't want to cut it too finely. Yeah, sure.
Those elements could cause specific actions.
Yeah.
Possibly independent of memory. I was just thinking about like our brains, you know, what is and it to recognize patterns, and if it's not tied to like a one-to-one relationship of a song to a memory or a lyric to a memory or something, like maybe subconscious elements.
Sure. And again, today we will talk about certain kinds of patterns. The categorization part we haven't gotten to yet, because we're still really low in the auditory hierarchy, as it were, cognitive hierarchy. Yeah.
I think that it's hard to fit certain things have worth was the church.
Yeah, it was prohibited. The church
church used that, and I think that it's because it evokes a certain emotional response. Whether or not it's tied to memory or not is it's old, hundreds of years.
Yeah, I mean the thing is. Ethnomusicologists have looked at a lot of this, and a lot of these things that just seem crystal clear and rock solid in Western music just don't do anything.
I'm taking a music class right now, and that's discussed a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And also, certainly, most cultures are ethnocentric. So certainly the medieval Western European culture was extremely ethnocentric. So they took everything that made an impression on them, they thought was just part of the natural world. So we've been mixing them around. Some of those of you that have been talking about emotions in general, what about emotions evoked by music? Is that the same, different? You were saying, yeah, Marcy, Darcy?
Like you can have a memory emotion in general
sure.
into music.
Sure. Yeah, we'll try to tease out some of that today. Anything else? Anyone know what arouses their emotions in music? I mean, I hear music that blows me away. It's interesting. Do your emotions change from the first hearing to posterior hearings? Do you ever like something more after hearing it more? Like it less? I mean, certainly you can get bored by music if you listen to it too much. Yeah?
Like
on first hearing or?
No, that's a weird thing. Uh-huh. Like when I say first.
Yeah. You associate music with images, colors? Yeah, synesthesia. Yes, I agree, yes. Anyone else? Synesthesia, are you familiar with that? It's one common thing with people with synesthesia that hear certain pitches and see certain colors. And so the people that are really good at it actually can categorize pitches by their color. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's not like this wall suddenly turns red. I'm not actually sure how they experience it. But they always say, I see a certain color. Now, it's not, I don't think suddenly, their visual field goes red or green or something like that. Okay, or it sounds red. Yeah.
I was watching one show where it said that they saw like a little, see something, but it was almost like an perceived something.
Though, can look at so it is like something that.
Okay. Yeah, I don't mean to say that it's not actually there.
Well, it's
probably hard to explain if you're mixed. Yeah.
Yes.
It's hard to say like what it is. Yeah.
Do you have a comment?
I'd be interested with synesthesis red or exactly if you.
Yeah, I don't know. Don't know. I mean, I'm sure something is known about that.
In the musical field book, they talk about all synesthetes. it's consistent relative to their chordals.
Yeah.
One person.
Okay, we got stuck on synesthesia. It's fascinating. It's relevant to what we're talking about, but little off. Anything else about emotions evoked by music? Yeah?
I'd say that
More like the human voice. Okay. Yeah?
They refer to music. Lyrics are divorced from so much music. I think that at least popular music ever divorced from the lyrics associated with it.
Sure.
To find meaning in music and find lost lyrics.
No, I agree, and that's a good point. Most of what we'll be talking about is just instrumental music. Yeah, in the sense that at least melodies, rhythms, and things like that. Abstracting away from whatever content of any words that are sung. What, Alan?
I just wanted to extend the binaural beats thing that I was talking about earlier because I realized that maybe not everyone is familiar. There's these programs called iDoser. I don't know if y'all have heard about it. But it's actually like something that's kind of gaining. While a lot of people want to say that it doesn't work that well, most people agree that it works to some extent. The implication is that they try to like sell specific doses of drugs where they give people like a specific pattern of binaural beats and then they're supposed to feel something. And a lot of the tests that were done before they came up with this program, apparently, were that they would just give people different patterns of binaural beats that happened, I guess, at different frequencies. And then they would try to figure out what they felt based on it, mm-hmm. and it was pretty stunning how similar people's emotional reactions were given different patterns of different binaural beats. And so then they came up with this thing. But the implication was that, I guess, just hearing different sounds in each ear can itself translate to an emotional response. The implication then, or the next implication, is that different kinds of stereo fields in music then produce emotional responses, and that seems to be something that's below the level of memory, or like actually where you understand even the notes, because there aren't really notes in the kind of way that we think of, but it's still music in a sense. Mm-hmm.
If you have a URL you can send me, and I'll send it out to everyone. Listen to that.
Whatever, and it like apparently they have like your, it like people like make it, they feel different.
Yeah, and
it's,
I mean,
like.
Well, one ear you hear one like noise, and the other one you hear a different, at a slightly different frequency. If there's any physics, I don't remember exactly how it works, but it's a really complicated thing. Like, the difference in frequency. You hear a beat, uh-huh. but if you only listen to one ear, then you only hear...
Oh, you say you hear a beat, you just talk about
like,
the beats, like,
when you put them together,
it's really different.
What?
You're talking about the beats, like, when people talk about beats, as in, like, the...
Like you hear a bumping sound. But it's only white notes that you hear in each year.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think part of emotional response has to do with tempo and in this comparing in general to in music. My instinct is that when there's increased tempos in music as opposed to increased tempos in just my environment, it influences me mm-hmm. more powerfully. Like I'm at a concert where they play very, very fast music. It gets your heart rate going and keeps you awake. It has these influences on your body that are somewhat related to emotion for sure, but if I just hear a jackhammer for a repetitive period of time at a high tempo, that's not having the same impact.
And you may actually ignore it, start to ignore you.
Right. Yep. There's a lot of people who like music and cry.
Okay, well let's move on. Psychologists have been thinking about this for a long time. And there's a theory. So we go way back to 1894, a guy named Dewey. I don't know if this is the same decimal, the Dewey decimal system for books. But he said that affect arises from the inhibition of tendency. So everything depends on what he means by tendency, right? This is, I think, what he means. A tendency is an expectation, a kind of chain reaction in which a present stimulus leads to a series of adjustments to a more or less specified consequent. The consequent is always implied in the tendency once the tendency has been brought into play. Now don't worry too much about this, because what we're going to say a little bit more specifically and more recently is that affect, so we're ultimately based on what Dewey said. Psychologists like to go back and give the first person that ever said something halfway useful credit for it. So affect is aroused with an expectation, that is a tendency to respond, activated by the musical stimulus situation, is temporarily inhibited or permanently blocked. So affect is aroused with an expectation is inhibited or blocked. Now, this is extremely general, and you may not actually know what this means right now. So we'll spend the rest of the class talking about this. But at least there was one, as Meyer 56 says, this has a profound ramification for talking about music. So if you have a group of listeners that have developed the reaction patterns appropriate to the work in question, the effective response of the work can be studied by examining the music itself, instead of trying to examine the responses of the listener or critic. So this is saying that if you can just look at the piece of music itself and try to figure out how it inhibits or blocks expectations. And of course, at some point, it should be setting up expectations and then inhibiting them or blocking them. So you don't have to be constantly asking a listener or a critic, do you like it now? Do you like it now? What about now? You know, you don't have to do that. You can look at the music itself and try to figure out what it's doing in terms of expectation. Thus, the subjective content of music can be discussed objectively. Now, and I guess I should add, and we hope this is the correct way of doing it. But this gives us at least a sort of methodology for looking at music that doesn't depend on any particular observer. So in that sense, it's objective. Okay, any questions about that? This might be a little bit vague, but this becomes the basis for a theory of music appreciation, I guess, or music analysis. Analysis is maybe a better word. Mm-hmm. No, the claim is that it's a cognitive ability of humans. The human mind works this way, so it should be viable for all types of music. It's, as far as I know, only tested on Western music. Yeah.
So basically,
something to that effect. And the question is, where do these norms come from? Which is something I'm going to come to. There's at least two sources. And so that's coming up real soon. Anything else? So yeah, I mean, I maybe shouldn't ask you for questions right now because it's a little too. But this has at least three advantages. Because expectation is known to be a basic strategy of the human mind, which underlies at least three things. So first of all, the ability to bring past experience to bear on the future. Okay, and that was one of the first things you said. Emotion arises from some kind of memory representation. So obviously the past experience, I mean, certainly one guess would be that by this we mean the fact that our, to some extent, our experience sets up expectations. And of course that may just seem to be blindingly obvious. As a computationalist, the second one is the one I like a lot. So expectation prevents a kind of computational overload by constraining the number of outcomes worthy of consideration. And I'm going to draw a picture in just a second that I hope will illustrate that. And it underlies the ability to efficiently direct attention and mental resources. And to a lot of ways, all three of these go together. Let me see. So the next slide tells me to draw the picture, right? Yep. Fortunately, I brought my own markers.
Well, what's the difference between
computational? Yeah, those two. These may not be independent factors, I'll put it that way. I think to a certain extent, all three of them are related. They may be like three slightly different ways of saying the same thing.
In one of my other neuroscience classes, it has to do with the ways in which it isn't necessarily, it's like that effect of the network is built into the way that it isn't going to do. Evolution is designed to be more efficient than that.
Okay, hold that thought for just a second. Yeah. So here's a note. Someone tell me their favorite note. Okay, here's C. So at some point in this musical work, we've heard a C. Now imagine, what are the possibilities for the next note? Okay. And let's just say C. I don't know.
G.
G, F, A, D,
B flat.
Okay. And there's actually lots more, right? So now, I mean, assuming we're doing a kind of playing a single note at the time kind of thing, this is a very simple visual representation of sort of the computational complexity of deciding what the next note is going to be. These are all possibilities, and in fact there's more possibilities, and this could very quickly reach the point that it's going to be computationally impossible in a finite amount of time to decide which one it is. I mean, if you have to look at all of the possibilities. So expectation is in some way going to rank these. Well, the theory is that it's going to rank these, and how shall I do this? Let's say this in some particular context, well, F might be my first guess, and A might be my second guess, and then I'll try C and D will be tried as my third guess. Or you could say do this in terms of probabilities. Say this is a probability of 0.0, 0.6, and this is going to be 0.4, and each of these is going to be 0.2, right? Which adds up to 1. And all these add up to a probability of 1. And that's a way of saying that my best guess is actually in this context, or for whatever reason, we don't care about the reasons right now, F is what I expect to appear, and I have a slightly lower expectation for A and then slightly lower for C and D. So this certainly reduces, is one way of reducing the computational load, especially if you can just kind of forget about a whole lot of other ones. So effectively, we assign the others a probability of 0, which means we're not even going to consider them as potential next nodes. That lowers the computational complexity, the computational overload, by constraining the number of outcomes. So that's what the second one means. And it's also an efficient way of directing attention. What you're going to do is direct most of your attention, or maybe all of your attention, if attention is just something that's not divided, to F. And that means that you create an expectation for F. Your attention, however attention works, is focused on F. And to the extent that these things, these expectations, come from past experience, well, this is how we're using past experience to have a bearing on the future. Okay, and I will eventually draw this out and put it on the slides. Are there any questions about that? Now, your idea about computation, about the the brain, does anyone know what's the one fun fact about the brain? How much energy does the brain use? Yeah, like 40% of your body's energy. For something that is only about less than 10% of body weight, brains are incredibly expensive in terms of energy. So the idea is that brains are heavily optimized to do what they do as efficiently as possible. So certainly, this is one way of reducing the amount of energy a brain has to work to figure out just something as simple or maybe complicated, I don't know, as understanding music. So ultimately, these notions of computational efficiency for any kind of computational system that has a physical realization, and especially for what is sometimes called natural computation, brain-based computation, which are heavily, heavily, heavily constrained by evolution to be as efficient as possible. That's another argument for where reducing complexity reduces the number of computations, which reduces the number of energy used, the amount of energy used, is also another kind of fourth argument or subsection of the second argument, or maybe the third argument, for expectation as to play a role in music, in fact, maybe in everything we do. Any questions about that? Okay, I drew the diagram. And there's a couple of other advantages. This is expectation is local, it being expectation. And I'm not getting into these other music theories. Every once in a while, I think Dr. Jaswinski drifts in this direction. Some musical theories seem to assume that the listener possesses a mental score of the entire movement before the second note has sounded. That would seem to be impossible, right? I should say that this theory is really concerned with first listen. I'll get to that in just a second. But expectancy, as my author says, absorbs the reality of temporal experience into its foundation, preserving the distinction between past events, which have become fact, and future events, which remain uncertain. And of course, one way we talk about uncertainty is through probability. It also appreciates the complexity of musical experience, it being expectations again. Some music theories simplistically equate the minor mode with sadness or a quick tempo with excitement. And in fact, you all have said both of these things today. Slide's calling you simplistic. In contrast, expectancy examines a musical landscape as a dynamic succession of events, preserving the constant fluctuation and sensation that characterizes musical experience. So there's at least there's two directions of expectation. So expectation can be bottom-up, which in this particular theory, or in music cognition in general, is often called schematic. But actually, and I didn't mention it, but this ultimately started from the Gestalt principles. So you could call it Gestalt instead of schematic or something like that. And top-down or stylistic, and I'll talk about the difference in just a second. Today we're going to concentrate on the bottom-up stuff. And in particular, we're going to define or semi-define this notion of melodic expectations, or melodic expectation is used in a very narrow sense to designate deeply schematic automatic primings, priming in the sense of psychology. What is priming? Okay, dog. Think of a word. Cat, thank you. Dog, for some weird reason, primes the word cat. Did anyone think of the word toothbrush when I said dog? Let's hope not. Then you would probably need to see someone. Black. White. Everyone says white. Black primes white. Probably, did anyone say purple? It doesn't prime purple. Exactly where these things come from is not sure, but the human mind definitely has the ability that one stimulus will make the response of another stimulus, another response faster or stronger. And that's what priming is. And it's a basic of experimental psychology. So priming here is used in this psychological sense, or experimental psychological sense, though we're not actually using it we're not using it for anything in this theory. By priming, we just say that the schematic expectations are automatic predictions based on the implicit extrapolation of typical patterns from an extensive corpus of music. So this means someone that's already learned a lot of music, has already been exposed to a lot of music, will react in this way. And for those of you interested in cognitive science or cognitive psychology, the author is semi-proposing that music is, or at least this kind of expectation generation apparatus, is a module in the sense of Jerry Fodor. But I won't get into that. Oops. What it's not is, notice that these expectations, we're kind of defining them as one that the listener is not necessarily aware of. This is very different from hearing a piece many times and having expectations about what you're going to hear because you already know the piece. So that would be considered a more of a top-down kind of expectation. Or sometimes a veridical expectation. Veridical, what does that mean? Truthful, yeah. So if you know Beethoven's Fifth Symphony really well, you know what to expect. And if you don't hear it, you can plausibly say that the piece was not played right. Right? So you heard something, and to some extent, a false playing as opposed to a truthful playing of the piece. And the claim is that the kind of the bottom-up expectations we're interested in does not have this kind of top-down information available. Now that may not be true, but at least the strong claim made here is that it does not have access to knowledge derived from already hearing the piece. Okay? So this leads us to the source of affect. The friction, the incompatibility between the schematic expectations and the actual occurring events is registered in the listener as experiences of tension. And Dr. Jaswinski has talked at length about tension, about the creation of tension and then the release of tension. So here we have at least our first sketch of a theory of tension, which is just violations of these schematic expectations. And in fact, this may be the only way of actually seeing or these expectancies is maybe in terms of affective experience, but well, I'll hold that. So we're not. This is not a theory of what composers usually do. It's not a theory of what sounds best, or it's not a theory of the continuations a listener might sing. Even though all of these things could draw on these kinds of schematic expectations. In other words, all of this also includes other things that stylistic influences, as it were, that is not a part of these schematic expectations. Okay, so here's really the essence of the theory of affect, at least in terms of schematic expectations. So the model has four parameters: stability, proximity, direction, and mobility. Unfortunately, the very first one, stability, is extremely complex, and I haven't wrapped my mind around it yet, so I can talk about the other ones. So stability captures the intuition that, in general, listeners expect relatively stable melodic events. That's all I'm going to say about it right now, because actually stating what they mean by stable is rather complicated, and I haven't quite absorbed it yet. But I think I understand the other three, and then I can tell you how they're put together. Yes. Sure. Yeah. That may be proximity. Hold that thought for a second. Yeah. So let's run through them first, and then you'd be happy to if you would expound on it. So proximity, and again, I probably should say that ultimately these are sort of based on the Gestalt laws. So that's where they come from, at least historically. And certainly proximity is one of the Gestalt laws, and so is direction. Stability, I'm not so sure about. Proximity, it captures the intuition that listeners expect subsequent events to be relatively proximate to preceding ones. Now, this, they're actually talking about pitch, and so it's kind of when they that expect small intervals between pitches to be continued by additional small intervals. This sentence is a little puzzling, and we'll have to come back to it. So subsequent events should be proximate to preceding ones, which means, well, I'll just show you what it means. The idea is that here's a list of pitch difference in semitones between two notes. So if the difference is only one, so there's only one semitone difference between note A and note B, this would be given the highest proximity rating of 36. Now, don't ask me where they got these ratings from. It's unclear to me whether they came from experimentation or just into the people's experts' intuitions. It's also unclear to me why they chose 36 to be the highest one, and 1/100th to be the lowest. As we're going to see, this all feeds into a mathematical model. So presumably these numbers were chosen to make the model work well, which is not necessarily how you're supposed to do things. But in any event, the idea of proximity is that pitches that are only differ by one semitone are proximate. That is, they're near to each other in pitch space. Pitches that are greater than 14 semitones near to each other, that's the maximum distance that this system, well, I shouldn't say the maximum, that gets the lowest rating of distance, of proximity, of the 0.01. So we see that the closer together in pitch space, so a difference of 1 gets the highest rating right here, difference of 2 slightly lower, 3 slightly lower, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it actually falls off pretty quick. Yes? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It's yes. So the idea, again, assuming you've done a transcription, you have a sequence of notes, this assigns a proximity rating to each note in that sequence based on the previous note.
They mean full stems. Just because all the programs I use, semitones, there's There's eight full steps, and how it's eight full steps in an octave.
Yeah.
How many full steps are there in an octave?
Well, it's eight between the two steps.
Okay, so right, okay. So then I want to say that semitones probably, I guess you could use different, all of the music programs I've ever used always has seven. Right, which is why I'm saying it's full steps. Okay.
This should be the smallest frequency change that's recognized.
Yeah.
That's what it's meant to say.
So how many semitones are?
Yes.
What does
that are okay? It reflects a kind of spatial expectation that when we hear a note, we expect the upcoming. Well, given that the bigger is better here on the rating, bigger is better. The expectation is that the next note should be similar. So they call this proximity. It's sort of like similarity. So that's what this rating is saying. Now, this isn't the only factor that's taken into account. But it's saying that, for example, if there's 14 semitones of difference, that's off the edge of the proximity rating. That's like really, really bad. Because ultimately, the bigger the number, the better. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, wait, you wanted to say something first. I'm not entirely sure what. See, this is like the fourth generation of a theory that we're looking at right now. So it's based on what a lot of other people have said. Again, the expectations of the Western scale may be considered a top-down expectation. Okay. So this is, and again, I'm not entirely sure of the experimental basis of this, which is something I'll look at next time. Yeah. Presumably, yeah, because that's a possibility, yeah. I just copied their table. Yeah, that's a good thing to ask. Because we have a zero in some of these other ratings.
The proximity ratings, then, we were talking about, whether it's minor or major, their proximity ratings are bigger, right?
Different types of scales. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's why they're trying to come up with a distance measure that's absolute in some sense.
Right.
Yeah. So direction again. Let me just go ahead and give you the. It's actually better understood in a picture. So here's the strength of expectancy. Low being at the bottom, high at the top. So if there's a small interval between successive notes, that gives, what would you call this? Well, here's the least and here's the most expectancy. So this gives, like, it's not actually half, or maybe it's close to half. In any event, it's interesting. It's nonlinear. So let's look at this. So we also, it's shaded. Notice it's light on this side and dark on this side. So how shall we see? Okay, very large intervals should generate a strong expectation for reversal, but very small intervals should generate only a moderate expectation for continuation. That's kind of like what this represents. I mean, that's the intuition that this little graph tries to represent.
Mm-hmm. Can I just make sure?
Yes.
Is the first thing reversible?
Pardon me?
Is the first thing reversible?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That's why this is hard to put into language. Okay, there's just one more mobility. It's the fact that in general, melody moves. It doesn't stay on the same note. So essentially, the mobility just says if the expectation for mobility is only 2/3, if it's the same, and one in all other cases. So the interesting thing is that these are put together to a... Oh, shoot. Oh, I was afraid of that. Okay, the box means multiplication. So a pitch X is expected to follow pitch Y by amount Z, where Z is calculated as the stability rating for X multiplied... Sorry, that didn't come out. By P, the proximity relation of X, multiplied by D, the direction rating of X, and M, the mobility rating of X. I should have switched those. So this is what I was...
My D is just added.
I don't know. Again, this is there's at least three other versions of the theory before this, which I didn't want to get into. So what this is, remember I off the top of my head at the beginning of the semester said, well, music cognition has to do with predicting what the next note is going to be. And given some of the trends in cognitive science, I thought that was a reasonable thing to say. Here is where someone actually tries to calculate this, at least for these kind of gestalt or lower level schematic kinds of relationships. So just relationships that hold between two adjacent notes. Oh, that's already repeated. Okay. And so next time we'll actually try to calculate this for some stuff, and I'll go back and talk about what stability is, because I kind of skipped over that. And then see, we'll try to see if that actually matches with any of our intuitions about anything. Yes? Again, this should be, though I haven't seen them make the claim, this should be common to all humans. I mean, it's like low-level vision. This is a kind of low-level hearing in which it's assumed. It's one way of looking at this, even though we're talking about music, I mean, this could be, you could think of this as a theory of how sound works. In general, when we hear a sound, we expect, at least from natural phenomena, we expect the next sound to be somewhat like the preceding sound. Okay? And we expect certain changes in certain directions in certain ways. Music is apparently maybe a little more complicated. I don't know. But yeah, this should be common to all humans. And for all I know, to monkeys too. Yeah. Yes. This is a kind of sensory processing. It's not really, I don't like distinguishing perceptual from cognitive stuff. But this is just a kind of sensory processing. Presumably it's taking place in primary auditory cortex, presumably. Because this doesn't involve any of the things we actually learn about musical styles or things like that. Okay. Were there any other questions, comments? Yes?
Mm-hmm. The whole chart, would it happen to be semitone?
Sure. That was a definition of semitone from Western music. Yeah, I mean, I know what they mean is the smallest distinction in frequency that is used in music. Okay. That's what they mean. Now, I know a lot of this research is heavily biased towards Western music because it's all done by Americans and Europeans.
Even if it is by me, because, whether you choose 400 or, so it doesn't matter where you start.
I mean, I hope so. I know that's what their intention is. Whether they fulfilled that intention, I don't entirely know. Anything else? Yep. Okay. So I'll see you a week from now and also on Wednesday.